In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. He came as a witness, to bear witness about the light, that all might believe through him. He was not the light, but came to bear witness about the light. The true light, which enlightens everyone, was coming into the world. He was in the world, and the world was made through him, yet the world did not know him. He came to his own, and his own people did not receive him. But to all who did receive him, who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And we have seen his glory, glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. John bore witness about him and cried out, "This was he of whom I said, 'He who comes after me ranks before me because he was before me.' And from his fullness we have all received grace upon grace. For the law was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. No one has ever seen God. The only God who is at the Father's side, he has made him known."
And if you can make sure that you could see that reading, John chapter 1 there in front of you as well, then we're going to work through it a little bit together. They're very famous words. And I think they're going to prove to us the truth of something that was once said by C.S. Lewis. He said this, see what you make of it. "Christianity is a statement which, if false, is of no importance, and if true, is of infinite importance. The one thing it cannot be is moderately important. Well, I don't know what you have planned for Christmas this year. I'm sure that for some it would be a time of great happiness and family celebrations, and for others probably a little more blue than white. There may have been hard things that have happened in the year, the loss of a loved one, loss of work maybe. Whatever you're getting up to, I do very much hope that it will be just as good as it possibly can be for you this year with those that you're with. But what I'd like to do in this Christmas address for just a few moments is to reflect with you on these very famous verses from John chapter 1 and to learn a couple of key Christmas lessons from them that will, I trust, take us right to the heart of Christmas and provide us with some lasting comfort and hope to take with us into the new year. The first lesson is this: Christmas means that we can know God. Christmas means that we can know God. For my birthday this year, I was taken to see a play at the Old Vic called Inherit the Wind. We don't get to the theatre much, but it was a fantastic play starring Kevin Spacey. It made such an impression on me that I brought the script on the way out. The play is a fictional account of the Scopes trial in 1920s America about whether Charles Darwin's evolutionary theory ought to be taught in schools. And the two main characters are the two lawyers in the trial. One is a Reverend Matthew Brady, who apparently represents the Christian point of view, and his opposite number is Henry Drummond, played by Kevin Spacey. And it's a play that captures brilliantly, I think, much of the mood music of our time when it comes to questions of truth and spirituality, because it makes a really big virtue of being open-minded, and it makes it a crime to be someone who can claim to possess the truth. It's all about intellectual freedom in that way. There's one key moment in the play when Spacey's character says, "The man who has everything figured out is probably a fool. It takes a very smart fella to say, 'I don't know the answer.'" And so, as you might expect, the fundamentalist Christians are portrayed as being anti-intellectual and anti-progress and anti-just about everything else. And the fundamentalist atheists, on the other hand, are presented as being cold and heartless. But the agnostic, the one who is open to everything but certain of nothing, well, that character is portrayed as being kind and likable and funny. You'll see why I say the play captures the mood of our times. We know that there are some fundamentalist atheists on one side, some fundamentalist believers on the other, but our culture encourages us to take our seat on the fence in the middle, admitting we don't know, maybe believing we can't know, keeping any belief that we have private, and concentrating instead on being good people. And I want to suggest this morning that these verses from John chapter 1 challenge, take that sort of virtuous agnosticism and meet it head on. G.K. Chesterton once said, "Merely having an open mind is nothing. The object of opening the mind, as of opening the mouth, is to close it when something solid is put inside it." He says, "The trouble with many today is that their mind is open at both ends." And John's purpose in these few sentences is to give us solid reality, authentic truth, upon which we can close our minds and build our lives. See, for example, with me what he says in verse 18, the last sentence on the sheet there. "No one's ever seen God, the only God who's at the Father's side. He has made him known." I take it the first half of the sentence isn't very controversial. No one's ever seen God. That's why there's so much confusion about his existence and identity. No one's ever seen God. But the second half of the sentence is the first bit of good news this Christmas. God has not left us in the dark about him. John continues, speaking of Jesus, "The only God who is at the Father's side, he has made him known." Let me illustrate it rather trivially. Imagine I got a mystery guest to come and stand up here this morning, and I asked you to try and deduce something about him just by looking at him. And so one of you looks at him and says, "I think he's probably a builder from Battersea." And someone else takes a look and says, "No, his hands don't look all that dirty. I think he's probably a banker from Belgravia." And someone else has a go, "I think he might be a butcher from Brixton." And we could carry on with all the bees we could think of for as long as the morning continues. But the point is, we would be none the wiser because we still wouldn't know for sure who the mystery character was. But then if someone else got up and said, "Actually, that man up here, this mystery guest, he's my father. And look, you can see the proof here on my birth certificate. And here he is in our family photographs. Now let me tell you something all about him. Actually, he's a broker from Balham," or whatever it happened to be. All of a sudden, the game would have changed because now we would be in possession of authoritative information that had been revealed to us by someone in the know. And that is what Christmas is all about. It tells us that God the Son came from heaven to be born as a baby in a manger in order that we might know him. See how verse 14 puts it? "The Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have seen his glory, glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth." He's saying when we look at that little baby in the Christmas manger, we're looking at a baby that is like no other because we are seeing God as he really is. That's what God's glory means here. It means when we see Jesus, we're not just seeing some pale imitation or approximation of God. We're seeing the one who, as verse 3 puts it, "through whom all things were made and without whom nothing was made that has been made." We're seeing the creator. We're seeing the source of all life in visible form in front of us. So I suppose the Christmas question is, how big is your Jesus? Maybe at some point a Christian friend or colleague has said to you, "Look, Jesus is so important, you definitely ought to give some time to thinking about him." Maybe to reading one of these accounts of his life or coming on the Christianity Explore course that's been mentioned. It would be a great thing to do. It strikes me these verses are saying rather more than that. They're not just inviting us to have a think about Jesus if we choose to do so, if we can fit it in amidst the busyness of everything else. Rather, they're instructing us to sit up and take notice of him. They're saying he's bigger than you think he is. They're saying this man is your maker. They're saying this baby is your God. The exhibition in the Turbine Hall of the Tate Modern at the moment is a vast black box. I don't know if you've seen it. It's by the Polish artist called Mirosław Balka. It's called How It Is. And apparently it's meant to, I got this from the poster outside rather than the experience, I hasten to add. It's meant to explore the way we interact with the unknown, if you're into that sort of thing. So you walk up a slope into a room that is entirely dark. I went in the other day. It's true, you can see absolutely nothing. You're not quite sure whether the flooring is going to be level underfoot. You're not sure if you're going to bump into anyone along the way. And so it's meant to be disconcerting and unsettling as you walk into the darkness. The poster on the wall outside says, "The unknown can be terrifying, especially if it is also without light." For many, God remains unknown. But here is the wonder of Christmas, that we no longer need to be in the dark about God. You may know Jesus once said, "I am the light of the world." And he was claiming to be able to turn the lights on, to introduce us to God as he really is. And the great news there is that that means that all of the confusion can be over. In his book, In God We Doubt, John Humphreys, which he calls The Confessions of a Failed Atheist, and he speaks of his ultimate failure in life to find big answers to the big questions that he's had. He says, "Along the way, I've experienced the indoctrination of confirmation classes, the anticlimax of the Eucharist, and the futility of prayer. And so I end up, at any rate so far, as a doubter." Well, I wish you'd read John chapter 1, because it's here to say that we don't need to be imprisoned in doubt about the nature or existence of God any longer. Because the baby in the manger who grew up to be the very epicenter of human history is the living answer to all of our questions. He enables us to know truth about God because he is God. I have to say, that's very much the way it worked in my own life. I grew up believing abstractly in the probable existence of a God, but I was entirely in the dark about his nature. A bit like if you've ever spent some time in a big old house somewhere and you can hear someone moving around upstairs and you know they're there, but you're not quite sure who they are or what they've got to do with you. Well, so God was a distant and impersonal concept to me. But again, he doesn't need to be. Jesus is God comes through the ceiling. Christmas means that we can know God. Not just facts about him, but we can know God. It's such great news for the Christian at Christmas time. I was having lunch with a man this week who knows that when it comes to the things of God, he is chasing shadows. He's fiercely intelligent. He's enormously successful. But when his children ask him a question about God, he is flawed because he doesn't have the faintest idea where true reality lies. I remember seeing someone else, a Christian, not far from death. What she really wanted to know, is this thing true? Not just true enough to make me happy in this life, but true enough to get me through death. Is this thing true? And Christmas says, yes, it is. Do you know, in the whole of human history, only two people have been so great and made such an impact on the people around them that the people haven't just asked the question, who is this man? But they've asked the question, what is this man? Because he seems to be more than human. They did it with Buddha and they did it with Jesus. But the really interesting thing is that the reaction of those two men was entirely different. Now, Buddha said very emphatically at every available opportunity, "No, don't look at me. It's not about me. I'm not God. Just look at my Dharma. Look to my teachings. That's where the action is." But if you were to read on in John's Gospel this Christmas, you'll see that when some people start to treat Jesus as God, when they get on their knees and worship him, he doesn't brush them off and tell them that they're overreacting or that they're looking in the wrong place. Actually, he welcomes their worship very gladly. Well, I wonder what part Jesus plays in your life at the moment. If Christianity's false, Jesus' only importance is as a figure of historical inquiry. But if these words are true, and John's gospel is full of reasons to believe that they are, then Jesus is of infinite and eternal importance because he's our God. Maybe I could put it like this. If at the moment my reaction to Jesus is not extreme, if at the moment I'm a little bit take it or leave it about Jesus, I think that can only mean that I haven't even begun to come to terms with the scale of his claims. Someone might dismiss him as a bit of a madman, or they might get on their knees and worship him. The one thing he can't be is moderately important. Christmas means we can know God. I want to move more briefly, if I may, onto our second key Christmas lesson. It doesn't just mean we can know God. Christmas means we can know God as Father. We can know God as Father. Let's see that from verse 11. If you go and stand with me, please. He, Jesus, came to his own, and his own people did not receive him. But to all who did receive him, who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. You'll see the verse highlights some two different responses to Jesus. Here he was, God in a body, and only some people received him, while others made the deliberate decision not to do so. There was a time at my school when the Queen came to visit, and you can just imagine the preparations. The gardens were manicured, the children were polished, we had to rehearse standing still. They laid out a red carpet, they even fitted a new toilet and a basin with special gold taps just in case Her Majesty had the urge, because the Queen was coming and we wanted to make her feel welcome. That just for the Queen of the Commonwealth. Can you imagine the welcome party that would be fitting for the King of the Universe? Makes verse 11 something of a shock, don't you think? Jesus came to his own, and his own people did not receive him. It's a decision that was made by many of the Jewish people of Jesus' day, and it's a decision that's made by many of our contemporaries today. I always think it's very evident in our culture at Christmas time. In the midst of that, the great consumer orgy and feasting of December, and then in the sales shopping and health drive of January, does our culture receive Jesus as the King of Christmas? It's a truth wonderfully illustrated, I think, in Oscar Wilde's book, The Picture of Dorian Gray, which they made into a film this autumn. The plot is that Dorian Gray is an incredibly attractive young man whose portrait is painted so beautifully that when Dorian sees it, he makes a sort of Faustian pact. His dream is that as he gets older and older in life, his own face will retain all of its youth and beauty. But all of the scars that come from age or careless living won't be seen on his face, but instead on the portrait in front of him. And Dorian gets his wish. And so he proceeds to commit himself to a lifetime of indulgence and sensuality and evil and even murder. And all the while, his own face remains pure until one day, alone and pensive, he uncovers the portrait of his youth. I don't know what you do in those moments in life when you say something, you do something, and you get just a little glimpse of what you're really like on the inside. Initially, Dorian is sickened by what he sees in front of him, but then his reaction very quickly, he just becomes terrified that he might be exposed publicly. And so rather than facing up to this reality, he buries the portrait in the attic. The climax comes when the artist himself discovers the portrait and confronts Dorian and implores him to turn his life around. It's amazing that it should be Oscar Wilde writing this stuff. But the artist says to Dorian, doesn't God say somewhere in the Bible, come, let us reason together. Though your sins be as scarlet, they shall be as white as snow. Though they be red like crimson, they shall be as white as wool. And so he pleads with Dorian to seek God's forgiveness. And so Dorian has another opportunity to face up to reality and change. Will he do it? Actually, so determined is he to silence this accusing voice that he reaches for a knife and kills his friend. When Jesus came into the world, his own did not receive him. When he told them of their sin, they hated him. In fact, so determined were they to silence the accusing voice that they strung him up on a cross and crucified him. Not many reject Jesus quite so graphically today. Most prefer just to ignore him a little bit, to bring him out like a relative every now and again, and probably at Christmas time. But the crime is the same. He came to us, his own, and his own did not receive him. It's a terrible mistake, and it's one that would haunt us for all eternity. But then verse 12 is the great promise of Christmas. Will you enjoy it with me just as we close? To all who did receive him, who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. And to receive Jesus is to accept him on his terms. And to everyone who receives Jesus as their Lord and God this Christmas, well, God personally gives the right to become one of his children. Don't know if you've ever had that experience of standing at a school gate and watching as a small child is reunited with a much-loved parent. If you have, you'll have seen the child's eyes light up and book bags and lunch boxes being thrown to one side as the child sprints and throws themselves into arms of love. Some will know here, I guess, what it is to be loved in a happy family. Some only able to imagine how good that would feel this Christmas. But to any and to all who receive Jesus, God gives the right to become children of God himself. It doesn't get any bigger than that or better. So if our first Christmas question was, how big is your Jesus? I suppose the second must be, what will you do with him? It's very striking in these few verses that in John's mind, there's only two options. If I'm not receiving Jesus today as my God, then I am rejecting him. I suspect there are some here that want more evidence. Let me say, that's a right response to these verses. John intends for us to be eager to turn the page in his gospel and to find the evidence that will substantiate the claims that he's making in this introduction. Because as C.S. Lewis put it, if the claims of John 1 are not true, then Jesus is of absolutely no importance. But if they are true, he's of infinite and eternal significance because he's your God. So I hope you'll want to read further. I hope you'll take away a copy of John's Gospel as our guest this morning. We'd love you to read it, and we'd love to help you process its contents as well. You could do that with us any Sunday of the year, actually, or in one of the Christianity Explore courses that are advertised on the back that William's mentioned already. I suppose the one thing that no one would do would be to reject claims of this magnitude without first giving them serious consideration. The one thing Jesus cannot be is of moderate, maybe I'll get to him next year importance. Let's not miss the scale of the offer this Christmas, though. Verse 12 is one of those verses you can write your own name in to help you to feel the force of what John is saying. Not just to all who did receive him, but to me, to Paul Clark, who did receive Jesus. To you, whatever your name is, if you receive Jesus, to you, God would give the right at that very moment to become a child of God and an heir to the richest estate in the universe, heaven itself. Christmas means that you can know God as your Father. Merry Christmas.